Okay, so we've been going through the first chapter on Sotapanna, the spiritual turning point, and been going over the four supports or constituents, factors for stream entry. Supurisa Sangh Seva, association with superior persons, Saddhamma Savana, hearing the good Dhamma, and Yoniso Manasikara we've started on that and haven't quite finished the section on Yoniso Manasikara. Okay, so the significance of Yoniso Manasikara, the wise reflection, can be seen more clearly in this next passage. The mind's ability to reflect on and consider the true nature of things affects its ability to penetrate the Dhamma. Particularly, if the heart perceives Nibbana as something unsatisfactory, it would not conceive the desire to realize it as a goal. Also, this capacity of the human mind to miss what is important by not paying appropriate attention is quite ordinary, but it has troublesome consequences. So, and I've got a truncated version of these. There's sort of four short suttas, and this is very truncated. So I thought I would read the suttas. There'll be a bit of repetition, but I think it's worth impressing on the mind. This is from Anguttara 6 of the Sixes, Suttas 98, 900, and 101. Bhikkhus, it is impossible that a bhikkhu who considers any conditioned phenomena to be permanent will possess a conviction in conformity with the teaching. It is impossible that one who does not possess a conviction in conformity with the teaching will enter upon the fixed course of rightness. It is impossible that one who does not enter upon the fixed course of rightness will realize the fruit of stream entry, or the fruit of once returning, fruit of non-returning, fruit of arahantship, or arahantship. There just is a fixed course of rightness is a synonym for the sort of the appropriate conditions to realize stream entry, and that having faith in, I was saying, conviction. But having faith, having confidence, just having confidence in the teaching, and this is beginning in particular. So it is possible, and the opposite is true. It is possible that a bhikkhu who considers all conditioned phenomena to be impermanent will possess a conviction in conformity with the teaching. It is possible that one who possesses a conviction in conformity with the teaching will enter upon the fixed course of rightness. It is possible that one who enters upon the fixed course of rightness will realize the fruit of stream entry, fruit of once returning, fruit of non-returning, or arahantship. So it's just sort of laying out that reality of being able to, as I said, it's to be able to reflect on and pay attention to and accept the true nature of things. There's got to be something permanent. There's got to be, and of course it goes through because anicca goes through dukkha, goes through anatta. It's impossible. Considers any phenomena to be self. Will possess a conviction in having faith, having confidence in conformity with the teaching. Yeah, it's impossible. It's impossible that not having that acceptance or confidence in the true nature of things would enter into the path of stream entering. It's just the way things work. So the necessity of reflecting and using yoniso manasikara, because that's where the context of this is, in the context of developing and paying attention to yoniso manasikara. And the last one is, because it is impossible that a bhikkhu who considers nibbana to be suffering will possess a conviction in conformity with the teaching. It is impossible that one who does not possess a conviction in conformity with the teaching will enter upon the fixed course of rightness, da-da-da-da, through arahantship. Because it is possible that a bhikkhu who considers nibbana to be happiness will possess a conviction in conformity with the teaching. It is possible that one who possesses a conviction in conformity with the teaching will enter upon a fixed course of rightness. It is possible that one who enters upon a fixed course of rightness will realize the fruit of stream entry, fruit of once returning, fruit of non-returning, or arahantship. The sense of yeah, really actually looking on the goal of Nibbana as something desirable, something that is as if you think, well, it's just, what's the point of practicing? Because it's just miserable anyway. It's just, okay, I'm miserable here, I'm miserable in Nibbana, what's the point? So it's but that sense of, oh yeah, this is, one's really uplifted and encouraged by the possibility of real happiness and peace. Any questions?
I'm not sure if it's implied, but one of the things that in the earlier chapters talking about the imagery of fire and heat, that tapas was considered to be the sort of goal of meditation practice. You're
right.
Building up this sort of psychic heat.
Right.
Tapas literally means heat. And that just using the language of Nibbana can sound like it's going in the opposite direction.
Right.
And so that if you're working hard to develop all this tapas, you're a tapasin, you know, you're, then why would cooling down be helpful? That's going in the wrong direction.
Right.
And
right,
so that
right.
it's not spelled out in that
it's
way.
It's not spelled out, but it is because it's quite true. I think it was in the Buddha's time that was a bit confounding. Right. And the language was quite specific. The Buddha really used that language of cooling as a counterpoint to the that kind of psychic heat and that building up that power.
Mm-hmm.
The fourth and final factor for stream entry is Dhamma Anudhamma Patibhati. This is usually translated as practice in accordance with the Dhamma. But it can have some other subtle nuances, such as practicing Dhamma appropriately according to the truth. There are many ways of practice, but some of them may, in actuality, not accord with the teachings or the true way. They may be popular or comfortable, but yet not be Dhamma. For practice to yield results, it must conform to truth or correct principle. Another nuance which could be teased out of the phrase Dhamma Anudhamma Patibhati is, quote, practicing in perfect accord with all levels and aspects of the Dhamma. That is, in the context of a gradual practice, there is the need to attend to fulfilling the foundations before going on to subsequent practices. To accord with Dhamma doesn't necessarily mean that one has to wait for perfect virtue before beginning to meditate. A common teaching, both in the canon and in the forest tradition, points out how wisdom fosters virtue and concentration. This still accords with the principles of Dhamma, but is not necessarily following the linear route. Another meaning for the phrase is making sure one follows the Dhamma as one has studied it. rather than studying one thing and then practicing in a completely different manner. And this is a quote from Samyutta 12, Sutta number 67. If a monk practices for the sake of disenchantment, dispassion, and cessation, with regard to aging and death, with regard to birth, with regard to becoming, with regard to clinging or sustenance, with regard to craving, with regard to feeling, with regard to contact, with regard to the six sense media, with regard to name and form, with regard to consciousness, with regard to fabrications, with regard to ignorance, he deserves to be called a monk who practices the Dhamma in accordance with the Dhamma. So that, of course, this is using the example of the 12 links of dependent origination, but I think it could be extrapolated or extended for practicing for the sake of disenchantment, dispassion, and cessation with regard to just about anything that is in a part of the Dhamma, the teaching. So that sense of how important that sense of, you know, nipita, viraka, nilota, or disenchantment, dispassion, cessation, how much that plays a role in the flavor of the Dhamma. That there's also where the Buddha says, you know, sort of like that flavor of Dhamma is a flavor of freedom, release. Yeah.
Let me go back to that, the sutta you went through. So yeah. The first bit was something about, anyone who considers any condition to be permanent.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I know Nirvana is not a condition, you know, it's unconditioned.
Yeah.
But my understanding, it is permanent.
Pardon?
It is permanent, Nirvana? Is that, can you say that? Or?
You could say that, but yeah, you're making it into a condition by doing that. I think it's important to treat it in a completely different, its own sort of category, and just sort of its nature, as opposed to a thing.
I
would definitely, yeah. I mean that Nibbana is well. I mean, because then you sort of think, you know, there is the unaging, unborn, uncreated, unformed. So that is what is. One could consider permanent.
And is it possible to pay attention to, you know, what's happening, and, you know, try and notice whatever it is that isn't changing? Is that a way mm-hmm. of practicing?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's really helpful to, like, turning the mind. How do you say, like, challenging the mind, playing with the mind in ways that shifts its assumptions and its habitual perspectives, its habitual conditioning. And that's a really helpful way of loosening the grip of clinging.
So permanence isn't the same as timelessness,
no.
And so it's which is a quality naturally mind-boggling and difficult to imagine, as Lumpur Sumedho said quite a few times, it's unimaginable, timelessness. So Nibbana is permanent, is casting it into a framework of time, permanence. So when you say unborn, unoriginated, uncreated, unformed, that's describing the timeless quality. So, and that's our imagination kind of freezes at the border, as it were, and it's groping to get some kind of way of thinking or describing that. But just taking a simple principle like that permanence is related to time, but Dhamma is akaliko, it's timeless. So that from a certain perspective you can say, and this question does come up, you're not the first person to ask that, that well, can you say Nibbana is permanent? We said, well, that's understanding that that's being sort of measured or described in terms of time, but it's not really accurate to say, like, eternity can sound like a very, very long time, whereas timelessness is a different dimension, different quality altogether. That makes sense.
Makes sense.
I don't know if this is in any way connected. I don't know if this is connected, but is there not something in one of the sutras, maybe I have heard, where it's something about it? Because the question that came up just then was, does Nibbana exist? And then, so it's that's which is different from saying there is the unconditioned. So does it exist? And it neither exists nor doesn't exist. Is that sort of a similar pointing in a similar way?
That was an earlier reading from the, in particular, was from the Melinda Panha, the Questions of King Melinda.
Ah.
And so the word exist literally means ex, as in out of, and the existere means from the Latin means to stand out. So Nibbana is real, but it doesn't exist. And Ajahn Panyawado, very helpfully, to some extent, if you like this kind of stuff, said, yeah, Dhamma is real, but it doesn't exist. The five khandhas exist, but they're not real. So if you look from the literal etymology of exist, to stand out, so that which is formed, tangible, time-bound, is that which exists. It's standing out from that, if you like, from the backdrop or the ground of ultimate reality. So human beings, time passing, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, the five khandhas, they exist, they stand out, they're tangible, but they're not real. There's forms, but those forms are empty. But then the Dhamma doesn't stand out. It's subtle and indistinct. It can't be described or unimaginable, as Lumpur Sumedho's. Quite a few Dhamma talks recently, he's gone into that sort of about trying to, you can't describe the unconditioned or Dhamma. So when I think, you know, what is the Dhamma? My mind goes blank. You know? And that, you know, what doesn't really apply. Image doesn't apply. So that it does take a bit of mind bending. But there are significant principles. And I think that way that Ajahn Panyawado put it is absolutely brilliant. Very, very simple, and really a good thing to take into the meditation, like just dropping that into the mix. Like, the Dhamma is real, but it doesn't exist. The five khandhas exist, but they're not real. Just let that be digested and to see if they're... Because our intuitive wisdom, the quality of panya, is not conceptual. And so that there's a way that the heart can attune and know that reality, know that quality, even if it can't create an image or an idea or words to describe that. That makes sense. That was what I was quoting was Ajahn Panyawado. It's not a translation, it's his own statement.
Okay.
Ajahn Panyawado.
Yeah. What are the differences between disenchantment and dispassion? What are their characteristics? Are they using them together?
Well, Nibbida. I'm just sort of looking at the, I mean, different words, disenchantment, Nibbida, and I'm just making it up, you know, in, you know, in, you know, in the sense that, you know, but the Nibbida is you know, just looking at the different translations. I mean, disenchantment, but this is also where, like, one this losing the flavor. For revulsion is how Bhikkhu Bodhi translated for quite some time, which is has a very negative connotation. But the Nibbida is a Dhamma term that is exclusively wholesome. So that the disenchantment, and it's hard to put it into English, because the disenchantment is sort of almost disheartened, but the heart is full, therefore it's not inclined to entanglement. Dispassion is also, I mean, of course, yeah, losing the passion for cooling is a cooling, a also literally it's oftentimes translated as fading away. So there's a fading away of kind of a passion. So, I mean, they're two different words. They've got slightly different flavors. But I don't think there's a huge distinction between them. But there is, in terms of progression, it's usually nipita viraga.
Could you say that? I couldn't hear the question, so...
Oh, the question was it what's it, yeah, what's the difference between those two, like disenchantment and dispassion? What are the difference between the two? But and so it's I mean, there are some, just because they're two different words, is trying to draw a bit of a distinction, but they tend to be a bit more of usually how they're, when they come up in the suttas. Disenchantment usually is talked about first, and dispassion later.
Also, the another English word that's quite accurate but has a negative connotation is disgust, yeah. And which has for something to be disgusting or to be disgusted, there's a negativity there. But the word itself literally means to lose your taste. So that dispassion is like that, the mind is no longer entranced or bedazzled or has lost its taste for worldly things. So like that first of the 10 reflections, I'm no longer living according to worldly aims and values. It's like consciously cultivating that losing your taste for excitements of things to see and hear and smell and taste and touch. And so it's very, very wholesome, but the English way of rendering it has got a negative connotation. To lose your taste is, it's like no longer intoxicated or carried away by childish or superficial glamour of things. So it does help to dig into the language somewhat. And then also viraga, the English word rage is related to raga. So a kind of heated, as a...
Definitely some passion.
Yeah, the kind of the element of kind of heated, excited, charged up. And then vi in that respect is not not charged up, not excited, not getting overheated about things that... sense objects and such.
Okay, onward. One way that accords with Dhamma is the relinquishing of stinginess. A Sotapanna's generosity is deeply ingrained in the heart, and actual fact, it is considered one of the qualities of a stream enterer is this kind of unstinting generosity. Sotapanna's generosity is deeply ingrained in the heart. It does not need to be thought through. It has brought about the need for rules to be laid down in the Vinaya, the monastic code, to protect those lay trainees, lay seka, literally ones in training, but referred to as at least stream enterers, and also once returners and non-returners, whose means were diminishing but faith increasing. So that if there, they would tend to be overly generous, and the Buddha felt it necessary for the Sangha to be alert to their needs as well. So it's like there's rules in the Vinaya of protecting the lay people from overextending their generosity beyond their what their means were. And there would be lay people who would be declared, you know, as seka, so that there was important to look after them, prepare them, protect them. Macharya is the Pali word used here as stinginess, which is defined in the dictionary as avarice, stinginess, selfishness, envy. It's one of the principal evil passions and the main cause of rebirth in the Beta Loka, the realm of hungry ghosts. Monks, and this is from Anguttara 5, Sutta number 260. Monks, unless one abandons these five things, one cannot realize the fruit of stream winning. What five? Stinginess as to one's lodging, stinginess as to one's family, stinginess as to gains, stinginess as to fame, stinginess as to Dhamma. Truly, monks, there are these five. Now the meanest of these five, monks, is the stinginess as to Dhamma. So it's a being not willing to share Dhamma, not willing to share the teachings.
There's a... That particular point brings to mind a story that Joseph Goldstein, probably many of you have heard of, is a very well-known Dharma teacher, one of the founders of Insight Meditation Society. And he was on a solitary retreat, and he had this very clear and luminous insight. And he thought, oh, wow, that's really great. I'm going to call Sharon Salzberg, another of the founders of IMS, and this is really interesting. I'll share this with Sharon, and I'll give her a call. And he thought, ooh, but I want to put this in my new book. And he had this kind of moral dilemma. His first thought was generosity.
Right.
And then there was the Macharya came in like, ooh. But if I share this, she might get in there and get it in the print before I do. So it was he's very sweet in the way he talked about it, but it was kind of acknowledging his stinginess with Dhamma. And then he realized, the stinginess with Dhamma, that's, I'm feeling it, but that's really not a good thing to follow.
Could you just repeat those five again?
Stinginess to lodgings. So stinginess as a lodging, stinginess as the family, I think probably just how one relates to family, not being, because it's also like generosity and kindness, and being, to gains or not sharing what
I think with family, I think it also relates to favoritism.
Yeah. Like
favoring your own family.
Favoring your own family.
Keeping things within your family, not wanting to benefit others. So, yeah. Like you're sort of keeping everything for your lot and not wanting to benefit
stingy.
Others.
Yeah, that's true, yes. I was trying to remember that, yeah. And you find that in many, many places where it's everything is focused on family and not really looking toward human beings in general.
What does the lodgings bit mean? Lodgings, what is that?
Lodgings would be, I'm thinking of some of the signs in America with all the sort of guns and bullet and you have no trespassing signs. You will be shot. and then fame, sort of lodgings, family gains, fame, that sense of, you know, trying to, not willing to share trying to keep things to oneself. And sort of, this is sort of self-aggrandizement in terms of one's recognition. May they recognize me and not recognize others. Not sort of sharing.
It might seem strange, but in some monasteries, people in a position of leadership, when they recognize that someone who's junior is quite talented or gifted or a good teacher, they will not give them the opportunity to teach. They will sort of forbid them from receiving guests, or they'll send them off to a remote place.
Some obscure branch ones.
Yeah, so our good friend, Ajahn Mahaprasad, was in a situation like that in California. And he was a young monk in a monastery, and he was very, very wise, very skillful, much appreciated by the people coming to visit. And he got sent off to Nebraska or some place where there was not a very big Buddhist population, or Indiana. It was like to a kind of hinterland, quite deliberately sent off to a remote province. Where he was to be pushed out of the way because he was gathering too much interest and being too impressive, and the then abbot of that monastery didn't want to share the honors. He wanted to kind of be the significant figure. So unfortunately, that kind of thing does happen. Has been happening since the Buddha's time, and that is a sign of stinginess.
You could sort of imagine if something like that happened here, and say Venerable Chitta was very popular amongst the lay. You know, after the meal, he'd have sort of 20 people coming to see him and talk to him. Mm-hmm. But there'd be nobody really wanting to talk to the one or two. Mm-hmm. That would be difficult, wouldn't it?
Depends on your mind. Your mind could go, great, he's looking after everyone, I can go take a nap. Fantastic. Carry on, Venerable. It really, I mean, joking, not joking. It all depends on the mind.
Yeah.
And it also depends on the appropriateness of, because sometimes some people seek that, and then that has to be sort of, okay, can you look at that?
Yeah. Yeah, it's not always particularly innocent. That junior person might be angling vigorously to be gaining the attention and so on. The Labha Samyutta on gains is it's got some really, which I mean, it's an odd term to use in English, but it's like that accumulation of fame, wealth, kudos. That Greek word is a good way of describing it. So the Labha Samyutta has got quite a few discourses about the kind of downside of looking for gains in terms of material offerings or fame or wealth or power in the world. And so it's some great suttas in there. I think we've got the dung beetle one is included, is it?
I can't remember what the name of that sung. Well, I've got it right here. The dung beetle is one of the favorites.
Unless you're the subject of it. Can you find it?
I'm just trying to remember what number the
Labha Samyutta is. It 17.
it's taken chapter up, something 17. Like that. Yep.
Wow.
Always. Yes, this is Sangyutta 17, Sutta number 5. Dwelling at Savatthi, monks, gains, offerings, and fame are a cruel thing, a harsh, bitter obstacle to the attainment of the unexcelled rest from bondage. Suppose there were a beetle, a dung eater, full of dung, gorged with dung, with a huge pile of dung in front of him. He, because of that, would look down on other beetles. Yes, sirree, I am a dung eater, full of dung, gorged with dung, with a huge pile of dung in front of me. In the same way, there is the case where a certain monk, conquered by gains, offerings, and fame, his mind consumed, puts on his robes, and carrying his bowl and outer robe, goes into a village or town for alms. Having eaten there as much as he likes, full of alms food, and invited again for the next day, he goes to the monastery and in the midst of a group of monks boasts, I have eaten as much as I like. I am full of alms food and have been invited again for tomorrow. I am a recipient of robes, alms food, lodgings, and medicinal requisites for curing illness. These other monks, though, have next to no merit, next to no influence. They aren't recipients of robes, alms food, lodgings, and medicinal requisites for curing illness. Conquered by gains, offerings, and fame, his mind consumed, he looks down on other well-behaved monks. That will be for this worthless man's long-term suffering and harm. That's how cruel gains, offerings, and fame are. A harsh, bitter obstacle to the attainment of the unexcelled rest from bondage. Thus you should train yourselves. We will put aside any gains, offerings, and fame that have arisen, and we will not let any gains, offerings, and fame that have arisen keep our mind consumed. That's how you should train yourselves. That's great. Okay. Stinginess as the Dhamma means jealously guarding one's knowledge and understanding to the point where one is unwilling to freely teach or pass it on. The deep generosity of a stream enterer's heart makes it impossible to be possessive of one's insights or experience, or to be worried that someone may be in competition with oneself. It is very inspiring to observe the selflessness of realized teachers who are always willing to share the teachings and their guidance with others. The following example shows how virtuous conduct and ongoing training in accordance with the Dhamma are necessary factors for realizing Sotapatti, stream entry. And this is a from Majjhima 6, and is broken up a little bit. Bhikkhus, dwell possessed of virtue, possessed of the Patimokkha, restrained with the restraint of the Patimokkha, perfect in conduct and resort, and seeing fear in the slightest fault, trained by undertaking the training precepts. If a bhikkhu should wish, I think that's the name of the sutta,
yeah.
As if a bhikkhu should wish, may I be dear and agreeable to my companions in the holy life, respected and esteemed by them. Let him fulfill the precepts. Be devoted to internal serenity of mind, not neglect meditation, be possessed of insight, and dwell in empty huts. The Buddha then continues to describe various ways in which the precepts bring benefit, such as being a source of merit for those who give support, relinquishing unwholesome mental qualities, entering the jhanas, and many other higher attainments, including, if a bhikkhu should wish, may I, with the destruction of three fetters, become a stream enterer, no longer subject to perdition, bound for deliverance, headed for enlightenment. Let him fulfill the precepts. Be devoted to internal serenity of mind, not neglect meditation, be possessed of insight, and dwell in empty huts. And just these foundations that laying down for as a, say, necessary and supportive conditions for the realization of stream entry. These are all, and of course, they're all beautiful qualities, and generosity, virtue, and also not beyond the capacity or capability of anybody, really. The next passage is an example of the results of not practicing in accordance with the Dhamma. It's a pretty striking example. King Ajatasattu was obstructed in his ability to realize stream entry even when listening to Dhamma directly from the Buddha due to his being a parasite. He had killed his own father, King Bimbisara. And the quote-unquote, his fate is sealed, means that, and it's a quoting from the sutta, means that due to his actions, he is irreconcilably destined to a very long stay in the lowest hell realm. And this is from Digha Nikaya, second sutta in Digha Nikaya, the Samanyapala Sutta. Then King Ajatasattu, because he went to pay respects to the Buddha and questioned him about the various teachers and teachings of and what are the fruits of religious practice, and it's a very beautiful sutta. Well, of course, it's in the Digha Nikaya, which means the long discourses. So it's quite a long discourse, but it is a wonderful sutta outlining all of the benefits and fruits of practice, and the Buddha lays it out quite thoroughly. And then King Ajatasattu, rejoicing and delighting at these words, rose from his seat, saluted the Lord, and departed with his right side towards him. As soon as the king had gone, the Lord said, the Buddha, the king is done for. His fate is sealed, monks. But if the king had not deprived his father, that good man and just king, of his life, then as he sat here, the pure and spotless Dhamma eye would have arisen in him. It's an incredibly powerful statement and such a kind of sad fate.
It's one of the what they call the heinous acts. It's not permanent, but it's just within this an individual's lifetime. If they kill their mother or their father, or they are an arahant, or they shed the blood of a Buddha, or they deliberately cause a schism, a division in the Sangha, then it's such heavy negative karma that it's impossible to get a perspective on that. It's like it's so strong that the Dhamma eye can't open, and it's that weight of vipaka, of resultant karma, it's not possible to see past that or through that in that lifetime. But future lifetimes, maybe, but it's like that density of karma is not...
Yeah, because I would say, like King Ajatasattu, despite that, I mean, that horrific karma of killing his father, I mean, he also did draw close to the Buddha and mm-hmm. seek out the Buddha's guidance. He was the patron for the first council, Sangha council, after the Buddha's passing. So
he built stupas.
So it's the good karma is waiting there for him. Once.
Out of curiosity, not because I'm personally involved, would it be also accidental killing that would be bad karma? Would that if let's say you accidentally killed one of your parents?
Well, if there's no intention, then it has a very different result.
Yeah, in order for, say, karma to fulfill its full rightness, then the volition is a intention is a is essential component.
Thank you.
But the problem, of course, is I mean, you definitely need some really good counsel, even if there was no intention. It's just preys on the mind.
So I also find it very striking that Angulimala, who killed so many people, managed to achieve arahantship.
Yes.
That says a lot about the bad karma of killing one parent.
Yes, and that was actually the why the one or one of the reasons why the Buddha went to teach him is because his mother was coming along that going to visit the son, and he had already formed the intention of killing the next person, and so the Buddha intervened in order to protect him from committing that karma.
One of the other things that I thought that it's very going back to Sapurisa Sangseva, the first of the four factors supportive of stream entry that I feel is I like to share, and I feel is a very good set of qualities to get the mind around, is what are the seven attributes of Sapurisa, and in Venerable Paiuto's various books he highlights these. And it's a kind of spelling out of mindfulness and full awareness, sati sampajanya, and those seven qualities. I find in order to be a sapurisa, a good, a well-rounded person, or a superior person, and there's these seven different qualities that are highlighted, and it's a kind of at least reflecting on it, it's sort of how you develop mindfulness and full awareness. Sati Sampajanya is like how you sort of broaden your scope of attunement to your life and the world around you and within you. So the first one is Dhammanutta. They're all in with Anutta. So Dhammanutta, and in this respect, it means considering causes. So where has this come from? What's brought this situation together? Like for these readings or coming to Amaravati or our involvement in a particular place or a job. So where does this come from? So the contemplation of causes. The second one is Atanutta, A-T-T-H, and that's to do with considering results. Where is this likely to go? What's the probable outcome of this? So you can't predict the future, but it's when you are moved by a fear or a desire or an aversion or a plan or an opinion, like, okay, if this is followed, where is it likely to go? Let's consider. So it's like, again, it's the Sampajanya sort of, okay, now what does my past experience tell me? What's when this has been followed in the past, what's been the result? So it's looking to probable results of action and speech. And then the third one is Attanutta, with no H, A-T-T. So knowing yourself, knowing your own character, your own personality. Are you an extrovert? Are you an introvert? Are you keen on meditation? Or do you really not like to sit still? You always like to be active. You know, what's your personality type? Do you like to be with people? Do you like to be alone? Are you do you love to think about food? Do you never think about food? All the different aspects of a personality that, so getting to know your own character as a sort of a field of study. So again, not to be feeling self-view, but just how does this one work? And getting to know what is beneficial, what's not beneficial, and so on. Then the fourth one is Matanutta, they're kind of in a neat system. So Matanutta is knowing the right amount. So this is a frequent subject of Dhamma teachings in the forest tradition, particularly around food, knowing the right amount of food to eat, like when's the appropriate time to stop But also with what's the appropriate amount of energy to spend, or the amount of time to engage with others, or with any of the aspects of our life. So that knowing the measure of things is another way of describing it. So matanyuta, and Lumpu Cha would use, you know, knowing podi, what's the right amount or just enough, and that. That is very, very frequent, I would say, theme of Lumpur Cha's teachings is knowing what's the right amount. And of course, the right amount keeps shifting, person to person, moment to moment, situation to situation. Then the next one is Kala Nyuta. Kala is time, so knowing the right time. So it's both about punctuality, which is one part of it, but also knowing how it's spending time, the right amount of time to be speaking, the right amount of time to be resting, the right amount of time to be meditating. So knowing the measure of things in terms of time spent and being punctual, being faithful to arrangements around time, that whole dimension.
Yeah, also that sense of time and place.
Yeah, the Kala Desa. The time, the places. Is this the appropriate time to be talking about something that, if you've had a major clash with somebody and then you find yourself in the kitchen on the washing up and you realize, I think I'll bring that up while we're on the dishes together. And you, probably not the best time, or that it's 7:28 before you're supposed to get to puja, and it's like, say, I've got a real problem with what you said to me this morning. This is nuts. Well, like you said with Lumpur Cha, don't give people feedback before the mealtime.
Just don't do it.
So, I had that when I was in Anagarika. I had that with the advice to the then abbot of Wat Pananachat. Don't bring up anything with him until the meal is over. He's a big guy, and there was a definite mood change once the meal had happened. Anything that needs to be discussed and sorted, it'll work much better after the mealtime. So knowing the time and place. Then the last two are knowing other people and knowing the group. So is it Pugala Nyuta first?
No, Parisa Nyuta.
Parisa means a group. Buddha Parisa, Bodhisat in Thai language, the Buddha Bodhisat, the community of Buddhist people. So knowing the group, are you talking to a group of people who've come together for the winter retreat at Amaravati? Or are you talking to a group of school kids who've come here because there's a school trip to the monastery and they've been dragged along, and three of them might be very interested, but 33 might need convincing. Are you with your family? Are you in a bus station? You know, where are you? What's the group of people that you're with? And so, attuning your attitudes, your actions, what you do, according to the group and how you relate to the group. Are you junior? Are you senior? Are you supposed to be in charge? Are you supposed to be following? What's the dynamic of the group that you're a part of? The Parisanyuta, and there's many dimensions to that. And then the last one is Pugala Nyuta, knowing Pugala means a person. So the character of another person, just like getting to know your own character, Atanyuta, Pugala Nyuta is, what is this person's character? Am I their parent? Am I their child? Am I their teacher? Am I the doctor? Am I the patient? You know, what's the relationship, or what's the dynamic that forms the connection between me and this other person, and what's important to them, what's meaningful to them, what's appropriate to engage? So, I mean, that's a very brief sort of sketch, but if you look in a number of Dhamma books, if you look up the Sapurisa, the seven qualities of a well-rounded or a superior person, good person, and I feel it's a really helpful list. I mean, the Buddha's lists are many and various, but it's a really useful list in terms of fleshing out one's skill and developing that sati sampajanya, mindfulness or intuitive awareness, mindfulness and full awareness, that sort of the way that we know our own life, our own character, and we know and relate to the world in terms of these living conditions and functioning in the world. Any comments or thoughts?
No, it's just as it is a really important set of teachings to reflect on and to use to sort of keep grounding oneself in, because there are all areas that we can be developing. And Prapayuto is a real proponent of that. I don't think I would have ever come across it without sort of his sort of going back to them over and over again in terms of individual practice and also communal, how to live in a monastery, how to live in society. These are major sources of well-being.
In his book, Constitution for Living, think it's particularly sort of spelled out in helpful detail. And most of his literature is available free online, but we should also have copies in the library. But Constitution for Living, but other places as well, he spells those out. But it's very useful to get to know those and to cultivate those. Now, that's the first on the list of conditions supportive of stream entry, number one on the list, Saparisa Sangseva. It's also the first thing on the list for dispelling ignorance. Is Saparisa Sangseva significant?
It's also just in terms of establishing a right view, it's not quite Saparisa Sangseva, but it's also hearing from another person.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're 7 o'clock.
That's all, folks.
So before we conclude, I just wanted to mention something, with possible permission. So we've been listening to to these Dhamma sessions, and probably been about 50 hours. And it's, what should we say? It's fabulous Dhamma, but the thing is that they're gonna end up as 50 talks on the Amaravati website, and it'll be very difficult to find where you want to know about these Dhammas, Saparisa Dhammas. Maybe you'll remember it's the last one, but there's so many in the middle. And so what I've done is about the past two years, I've been working on a project called the Ajahn Pasano Question and Story Archive. And what that does is it takes Lumpur Pasano's audio and the people who teach with them and splits it up into particularly the questions that people ask. So the question gets transcribed, and then you listen to the answer in audio, because there's so much more you get from listening to audio than reading a transcription. And it's all searchable. And so that is available. That's available now. I think it's got about 140 hours of audio available right now. And so the best way to get to it is just search Google for Ajahn Pasano Archive or Ajahn Pasano Questions. Either one will get you the top choice. And if you're inspired by it and want to help me transcribe all this, please get in touch.
Meanwhile, at Amaravati, Tan Adicho has taken the entire audio archive and run it through AI and has created text copy of the entire audio archive.
Whoa.
Which is also searchable by the subject.
Thank you, AI.
Thank you. So thank Tan Adicho, kind of amazing. And he's one of those guys, wasn't that complicated? So that's a result. It's not publicly available, but if you're living here, then the access can be provided. But That is a resource Tanadicho has been developing. About 7,000 Dhamma talks. I think so.
When do they start to record them? How far did they go back?
He was back to 1978.
Oh, wow.
Earliest material is Lumpur Sumato arriving in London. Oakenholt, that kind of thing. So, not a huge amount, but it's way back in the mists. Before some of you were born.
Will it ever be available if you're not staying at
I had not sure, but I think one can request access or put in a bid, and it can be approved of or not. It's just sort of it's in process of being developed, but that's where it sits at the moment. It's
we have the appropriate things to talk. And you said it's Ajahn Pasano's question.
Yeah, Ajahn Pasano questions or Ajahn Pasano archive. Just Google that.
Okay.